From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Evan Dawson. Let's start with a comment that had a lot of people talking this week. You might have heard that comedian Larry Wilmore hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Did you hear what he said? Well, he closed his remarks by referring to President Obama with a racial epithet. But Wilmore said he did it out of love and brotherhood.
We want to warn you that in this clip of Wilmore and in our following clip, you'll hear some language that you might not want kids to hear. Here's Wilmore's closing at the Correspondents' Dinner.
When I was a kid, I lived in a country where people couldn't accept a black quarterback. Now think about that. A black man was thought by his mere color not good enough to lead a football team. And now, to live in your time, Mr. President, when a black man can lead the entire free world. Words alone do me no justice. So, Mr. President, if I'm going to keep it 100, yo, Barry, you did it, my nigga. Did it.
Black writers across the country offered varying takes on whether it's okay for Wilmore to refer to the president that way. We invited three people to debate it. Chris Thompson is an engineer and a humorist. Kenny Jean is the founder and publisher of Our Voice, the magazine. And Tiana Magnan is the editor-in-chief of Open Mic Rochester magazine. In this clip, Tiana is responding to a white listener named Bill, who asked the panel, why would any black person use that term to refer to another black person?
It actually goes back to another question that you asked earlier, Evan, about, you know, well-intentioned white people who don't want us to use the word. And I think it goes back to that. Larry did not do this for white people. He didn't do this for anyone but black people. And to show and say, like, hey, we appreciate President Obama being our president and being black. And at the end of the day, after all 8 years doing all of this craziness, he still feels like our president. And I think that's what Larry is going for when he addresses him as, you know, my nigga. It's not just nigga, it's my nigga. And so I think that's what he's going for. And again, it's not, I mean, I understand that it made other people uncomfortable, but I think Larry did that specifically for the black community and to speak on our part to President Obama.
All right, so just to follow up, and I can't speak for Bill, but I think part of his question would go something like this here. And Tiana, by the way, is pointing out the use of the term with the A on the end, not the ER. If you missed that earlier, I think that there is some conversation about whether there's a distinction and plenty of disagreement, even in the black community, about whether there should be a distinction. But Larry Wilmore says there is, and putting an A on the end. In fact, Larry Wilmore said, I would never call him that term with an ER. I put the A on the term for affection. What Bill seems to be saying is that term with an A or an ER has been used to hurt for so long. It is the most poisonous term that we can probably imagine. And why can't you just say my brother?
Because you haven't felt the flip side of the love that comes with it. When you are on a campus and there are 5,000 people who don't look like you and you find the other one who does and they address you like, hey, my nigga. And you like, yes, my nigga. Like, I get it.
Wait a second. Chris Thompson like, was just thinking of support. I thought you said there's not a distinction between A and ER, and now you're agreeing with Tiana.
Oh, no, there's not a distinction, but there's a distinction in the way it's used.
Okay. Right.
Like, I worked in corporate America for about 15 years. Mm. My first year, I was 23. I was walking down the hall and somebody told me to clean up a mess because they thought I was a janitor.
Oh.
So I had to start dressing like, well, no one can see what I'm dressed like. Just, I'm in a three-piece suit. You don't know. I had to start dressing like that just so that my colleagues in business casual would not mistake me for a janitor. So when we started hiring more black people, oh, yeah. Yeah, I see him walking down the hall. Everybody does it, especially I'm from Baltimore. In Rochester, there are a little bit fewer black people here. So I'm walking down any hall, anywhere, in any part of the city, or walking down the street, and I see a black dude, and we just nod to each other. Like, that's just a thing.
You have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see it. It's not just me, because I've got some Hispanic friends who do the same thing. You know, women in engineering, In my company, oh yeah, all the time. They do the head nod. It's just like this identification that, like, I see you, we're here, just in case something goes down.
My nigga. My nigga got my back.
Right?
Now, you know what it is, Evan? The word been around before we were born, okay? Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the word was put on us, almost given to us. And what we did is we got creative with the word. Okay, they kept calling us niggers. That's what we were to them. Okay, we'll take this word. We'll embrace it. But you know what? We're going to put a twist on it. We're going to drop the ER and just put an A. And that A, I'm assuming strongly, that's where the camaraderie comes in. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's where the camaraderie comes in. It's not my nigga, it's my nigga, my brother almost. Yes, we can use the word brother. Definitely we can. But it's almost like we embrace that word only because, you know what, you called us a nigger. That's what you really think of us. Okay, we'll take this word and we'll get creative with it.
Next, we welcome the executive director of a national organization called the Christian Educators Association. The Washington Post recently covered them and explained that the Christian Educators Association advises public school teachers on how to share their faith without crossing legal lines.
So here's Finn Larson, their executive director, talking to us about their methods. After the Post article came out, many parents had questions. They wanted to know if the Christian Educators Association is advising teachers on how to convert students. They advise teachers to display the Bible on their desk, for example, but they tell teachers not to overtly proselytize. Here's Larson claiming that even though they want teachers to display their faith, they're not targeting public school kids for conversion.
My grandchildren are in public school. Quite frankly, I don't want people of other faiths to be proselytizing my Christian grandchildren. Same way, people of other faiths should be able to send their children to a public school knowing that teachers don't have a right to pull them aside and try to convert them from the faith that their parents are raising them in.
Okay, but isn't it also part of the mission to actually eventually bring more children into Christianity? I mean, you say, a Jewish child should be able to go and not be proselytized to. A Christian child should be able to go and have a Jewish teacher and not feel like they're being compelled to consider that specific religion. But the whole mission that you have is to eventually convert more children, isn't it?
No, it really isn't. I believe the call of the Great Commission is for all Christians to be open to bringing people to faith. But that's done in our churches. That's done in our community. That's not done in the classroom. That violates the First Amendment.
But if you're not fishing for students to be converts to Christianity, then unless the Washington Post quoted you incorrectly, why did you say, we're saying you can do a lot of things, it's a mission field, public schools, that you fish in differently? Fish for what?
That's really good. You read those articles well. Yeah, I was taken a little bit out of context, but it was fairly accurate. What I was saying is fish differently is that you display openly your faith. Let people know that you're a person of faith, and they certainly might be drawn to that faith, but you're not to close the deal, if you will. That they could research the faith on their own, they can go to an area church. But yeah, I believe it's a mission field.
Next, we have what I thought was one of the rawest and most genuine explanations of PTSD I've ever heard. Here's the background. Oak Hill Country Club is bringing the Simpson Cup to Rochester in September. That's an event a lot like the Ryder Cup, a golf event pitting the United States against Europe. But in this case, the participants are injured veterans.
The American captain is Steve Ogletree, and he's living with PTSD and depression. He served in Somalia, and he told us what life has been like since coming home.
I don't have a missing limb. But inside, there is a war going on all the way from 1993 until right now, today, 2016. And it's managed both by my family, medication, and I myself, through my job, I try to reach out to other vets and give back and try, you know, to let them know that it's okay to tell someone that you have PTSD. Don't be ashamed of it, and it can be controlled.
Absolutely. I very powerful stuff, Steve. And when you say that you felt broken down by it, Was there a moment for you where you felt like you didn't have a choice, that you hospitalization was going to happen? What was the low for you?
The low point came to me. I had gone to work. I was still in the military, and I was really in a bad situation to describe it as not sleeping, not caring about anything, my job or anything, neglecting my family. And I had spoken to a doctor, and I had somewhat of a relationship with him. So this particular day, I was going home, and I felt really bad. And I called the doctor, and I told him what was going on. And he said, do not go home. He said, turn around, turn your car around, and come straight to emergency room. He said, I should have gotten off at 3 o'clock today, but I'm still here, and I will stay here until I get you some help and admitted into the hospital. He was scared in a way that he didn't know what I wanted to do. The questions that he asked were, are you feeling like you want to hurt yourself? And I didn't feel like I want to hurt myself. I just had anger toward other people, per se. I knew I had my family at home, and I loved them, you know, but it's just the anger inside of me just will not let me rest. And this doctor got me admitted into the hospital. That's where I found solace, you know. It took me 2 weeks to sit down and really think about what had happened to me and to accept the fact that my life has changed and it will always be changed, and I need to figure out a way to manage it.
You can learn more at simpsoncup.com.
All right, let's turn to climate change in the context of faith.
Later this month, the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies at Nazareth College will host a conference that examines how faith intersects with environmentalism. Here's Nancy Rourke, the director of the Catholic Studies program at Canisius College. She's responding to a comment about recent studies showing that strongly believing Christians are less likely to believe that climate change is happening.
I think that it's also true that Christianity itself, just taking all of it, everybody, has a really troubling legacy in many respects. And Lynn White is a historian who wrote an article in the 1960s in which he identified he blamed the environmental crisis in the 1960s on Christianity itself and the legacy that that religion in particular has had in influencing us to understand our bodies and our environments and our physical realities as being less significant than the spiritual stuff. Taking these two aspects of life and separating them and then arranging them so that the spiritual stuff is important and the physical stuff is either not important or a little bit dubious. And Christianity has struggled with that way of thinking off and on through, you know, well, millennia, unfortunately. And I think that Lynn Wright was correct that a lot of that attitude is to blame for the ways that we have viewed the environment. But I think that for non-religious and anti-religious environmental writers, when you read them talking about what it's like for them to observe the natural systems that they move in or astrophysical phenomenon that they observe, there is a spiritual quality to the awe that they obviously experience in getting to know the nature of all these things. And I think that that is a point at which religions could do better and are beginning to a lot better, you know, to do better in engaging.
If you're interested in attending the conference, you can learn more at the Hickey Center's website.
Let's wrap things up with some dessert after a week of broccoli. Oh. That's a lot of puns. And I know Evan hates puns, but you use them a lot this week, so I'm allowed to use a couple in the podcast.
When did I use puns, actually?
You actually said dessert after a week of broccoli on today's show.
Okay, hold on. This is important. This is very important.
I'm listening.
That's not really a pun. That's an analogy.
Rap is a pun.
It's a metaphor.
Rap is a pun.
Oh, that's where we're going with puns. So rap.
Rap like a wrap that you eat. And we're talking about food trucks, so it's a pun.
Okay, see, I actually was used to using it as a metaphor, like broccoli for serious stories, dessert for lighter, but I don't use puns unless there's a really, really good reason. And that's why you were having some fun at my expense.
Okay. I was, yes.
All right, so that aside over, I get it now. Okay, go ahead.
Thanks. We talked about Rochester's food truck scene with a few different food truck operators. The city has loosened its restrictions on food trucks within the last 2 years, which has allowed more vendors to be on the streets for longer hours. But even though the city is more food truck friendly, our guests say more progress can be made.
First, you're going to hear Lizzie Clapp, co-owner of La Petite Poutine, on how Rochester compares to cities with vibrant food truck scenes. And then you'll hear City Council member Carol Lee Conklin on why she thinks Rochester faces unique challenges.
We recently were in Washington, D.C., and we were speaking to a lot of different food truck owners and their association. And just walking around D.C., you go through these squares or these circles, and you have just a mass amount of food trucks just surrounding these circles. There's still Starbucks. There's still lots of restaurants in the area. It's pulling people. It creates this epicenter of food and commerce and street traffic to these circles. I think Washington Square Park would be a great opportunity for something like that to happen right here in Rochester. And that's just a matter of getting the right people in the city involved and making sure, you know, we got to be safe. We got to think about traffic and being compliant in those means. But working on that, I think, would be huge. That's something we could pull and transfer to Rochester really easily.
All right, Councilwoman Conklin, what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I visited D.C. often, and I agree that food trucks there are an integral part of the street scene, the streetscape. I think it's apples and oranges to compare D.C. with Rochester. We're not a major tourist hub the way D.C. is. And unfortunately, our city was not laid out with the grid and the circles and the plans that D.C. was. It lends itself to that kind of circular activity. Washington Square Park is not a circle, and it's got one-way Clinton Avenue that's going to be one-way for at least the next couple of years. And it's got a very narrow street at St. Mary's, and it's got, you know, it's just, it doesn't lend itself to the kind of circular traffic that a DuPont Square, for instance, or Lafayette would lend itself to. I think the food truck legislation is an ongoing work in progress. We have a team of City Hall folks that meet regularly and are open to suggestions to bring to council. And I think council has taken very seriously amending their first legislation on food trucks. It really does add a vibrancy to our seascape, our streetscape.
Clapp says she hopes the city will open Main Street to food truck vendors. In the meantime, you can find a number of the trucks at one of the Rochester Public Market's 8 food truck rodeos this year. And we're seeing food trucks rolling in the Finger Lakes. The town of Lyons has its own food truck rodeo as well. Thanks for listening to our podcast this week. And a reminder, there's another podcast that you should be listening to as well.
Our WXXI colleague Veronica Volk is working with the Democrat and Chronicle's Gary Craig on their brand new podcast, Finding Tammy Joe. You can subscribe at findingtammyjoe.com.
Finding Tammy Joe tells the story of a 15-year-old girl found murdered about an hour south of Rochester back in 1979. They bring her story and her identity to life, and they could help bring her killer to justice.
Have a great weekend. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS 89.5 FM.
And of course, we are always on the WXXI mobile app, usually pun-free, unless it's accidentally dropped in. Sorry about that. You called, man. Thanks for calling me on that, Megan Mac.
No, oh, you're welcome.
You not nothing slide.
I've got your back.
I am Evan. I guess. I am Evan. She does. We're good. I'm Evan Dawson.
I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you Monday.